The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome for our first oral argument students from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Would they please stand? What class are you with?
Department of Justice.
Thank you. You may be all seated. We welcome you. And we have students from the Boscobel High School. Would they please stand? Good seeing you all, too, and thank you for coming. You may be seated. Yeah, high school students are here with a national award-winning program that is sponsored by the State Bar and this court. And we invite high school students from around the state to join us for an oral argument. And if they do, they're sent copies of the brief in the case they will hear. They may engage in extra activities relating to that case. And then they meet with a justice of this court noon to discuss the procedure of the case and how we decide cases and issue opinions, not the substantive issues involved in the case. Now, I'm assuming all of you have, oh, I'm not going to assume anything. If you do not have a summary of a case we are about to hear, the marshal has a summary and be happy to give it to you. It's easier to listen to this case and understand if you have a summary. Everyone has it? Okay. My notes show that the Boscobel High School students are not going to stay for the noon presentation. Are the UW students going to stay for a noon presentation? No. Okay. We will have no noon presentation today. If you like, you can. Oh, we might. We might because Oconomowoc High School is coming in on the next case, and my notes don't indicate they're not staying. So we will have a noon presentation. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Patience Robensack, and she will be with you with those who are here at noon. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left, Justice David Prosser. And on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. With the introductions made, I'll now call our first case, 05AP1516CR, State versus David Allen Brusky. Arguing on behalf of the defendant, David Allen Brusky, is Margaret Maroney, Assistant State Public Defender. Ms. Maroney.
May it please the Court. I represent David Allen Brusky in an appeal from a case arising out of Douglas County. The Circuit Court in Douglas County, the Honorable Michael Lucci, suppressed evidence that was seized from Mr. Brusky, seized from Mr. Brusky's travel case that was located in a car that belonged to a third person. The trial court ruled that Mr. Brusky had a reasonable expectation of privacy in his travel case, which was hard-shelled, opaque, and located on the floor of the front passenger seat of the car. The Court of Appeals reversed. The Court of Appeals ruled as a matter of law Mr. Brusky could not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in his travel case, because he did not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the vehicle. We argue that the Court of Appeals was wrong. The Court of Appeals applied a per se rule. The Court of Appeals failed to give the trial court's findings of fact and reasonable inferences the proper deference. And the Court of Appeals made an improper assumption that Mr. Bruski's presence in the car was unlawful. The controlling constitutional principles here are that we do not allow unreasonable searches, and unreasonable has been defined as either with a warrant or with probable cause and an exception to the warrant, or with consent. And none of those three scenarios are present in this case, and so this court should find that the search was unreasonable and suppress the evidence. The reason why the Court of Appeals erred is that it failed to give the circuit court proper deference. The defendant has a burden by a preponderance of the evidence to show that he has a subjective and that there is an objective expectation of privacy in the item to be searched. In terms of subjective, the evidence showed that the bag was located in a car parked behind a building.
Okay, now your argument is going to be that he had a reasonable expectation of privacy in the bag. You're not arguing he had a reasonable expectation of privacy in the car?
I am not arguing he had a reasonable expectation of privacy in the car. However, I argue that his presence in the car was not unlawful. The Court of Appeals authority relies on a case where the individual was unlawfully in a car. What we have is an unexplained presence. We know that the mother, when contacted about the car, said that her daughter had the car and she may have let a friend drive it. We know that Mr. Bruski has the keys on his person.
Now let me ask you,
yes,
as long as you're going into that, if that's an issue which you seem to think, and the police had no idea they came upon this car. I'm looking at the red brief, page 102. The officer saw a person passed out in the vehicle. He appeared to have, if I'm not mistaken, he had a part of a sandwich or a food in his mouth, and he was not too responsive or coherent. So the officers, when they came upon this, and then they didn't know, he didn't know how he got there. So does that make any difference, what the officers saw at that time, and then their follow-up as far as the mother didn't know who he was, he didn't know how he got there, and he didn't know her daughter except by the first name? Does any of that make any difference?
Well, Your Honor, regarding with the name, there's no indication that he was asked what the daughter's last name is. It just said that he identified the daughter as Jessica. He did not provide a last name, but there's the reasonable inference that...
Now, somewhere I thought that he said he didn't know what her last name was. Maybe
no, he did not provide it.
Okay.
But, Your Honor, what Officer Olson did in terms of talking to Mr. Bruski at the initial contact was certainly within good police work.
But
as the circuit court said, it did not rise to probable cause to believe that Mr. Bruski had committed or was committing a crime, or even reasonable suspicion.
Ms. Moroni, I just want to ask you about the keys issue. I know you argued that he had the keys on him. Wasn't there evidence in the record that at least some testimony to the effect that initially when asked by the officer, he declined having the keys on him?
Well, he was asked where the keys were, and he said he didn't know.
Didn't know,
yes.
Right.
And then also we need to keep in mind that he was woken from sleep. He was described as somewhat impaired. But regardless of the fact that he didn't realize he had the keys on him, that fact is something that supports the circuit court's finding that he had a reasonable expectation of privacy in the car because his presence in the car, no, I'm sorry, reasonable expectation of privacy in the travel case because there was nothing unlawful about his presence in the car.
But the police
Ms. Moroni, I was going to ask you, is this a fair way to state what the Court of Appeals did? The Court of Appeals said he had no reasonable expectation of privacy in the car. Therefore, he had no reasonable expectation of privacy in the travel case in the car. Is that fair?
That's the way I read the Court of Appeals decision, Your Honor. And I think it took a per se approach, and that's improper in analyzing Fourth Amendment issues. It should be very tailored to the facts. I would compare the car in this instance to somebody sleeping on a park bench, perhaps, or somebody who happens to stop in somebody else's hotel room. It is the premise where the search occurred.
Well, doesn't this tie into the whole idea of standing?
Pardon me?
Doesn't this tie into the whole idea of standing, that the defendant really has no standing to claim a reasonable expectation of privacy?
I think standing and reasonable expectation of privacy are used interchangeably I think the more recent terminology is reasonable expectation of privacy. And so once a person has a reasonable expectation of privacy, their rights are invaded if the government intrudes.
They can assert that their rights are invaded.
Yes. Then if there's a search without one of those conditions precedent, their rights are violated.
Can I just follow that up for a minute? Aren't you asking us to overrule the Callaway case?
Actually, in terms of the Wisconsin constitutional argument, I do not believe it's necessary for the court to overrule Callaway. As I stated in my reply brief, Callaway, this is page 4, is distinguishable on the basis because there was a question as to who owned the vehicle searched. And there's no question who owned the vehicle searched here. And we know that the mother did not have recent possession of the car. We don't know how long the daughter had the car. We don't know when the mother last saw the car. She didn't have keys to the car. So,
in terms of reasonable expectation of privacy in the vehicle, isn't it your client's burden to establish that he has the expectation in order to show reasonable expectation of privacy, if we're talking about the vehicle as opposed to the travel case?
The circuit court did not address the issue whether Mr. Brusky had a reasonable expectation of privacy in the vehicle. The circuit court went right to the issue, did he have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the bag? And it's our position that in assessing whether there was a reasonable expectation of privacy in that personal item, one of the considerations is the location of the bag. And the location of the bag was in a third party's car with unexplained presence, but no reasonable suspicion that any crime had been committed or was being committed.
Well, I want to just call to your attention on page 105, it's paragraph 15 of the Court of Appeals brief. When they go through this, it just seems to me, and just forgetting about that, here the police, you have to look at what the police came on. They came on, as I described you, or you indicated, that he was somewhat impaired. He was sleeping in a vehicle. He had food in his mouth. Maybe he was having medical problems, but they don't know. This is what they saw. And then he didn't own the vehicle. He didn't have the keys. They saw the bag. But the point I'm driving at, you say there's no more expectation here than there would be sleeping on a park bench. And I find that rather curious example. In other words,
I bring that up as an example in as much as there's no expectation of privacy in a park. It's open to the public, and I know the state has emphasized the fact that somebody could have opened the car.
There's more expectation. Maybe this was a stolen vehicle than it was a stolen park bench or something like that. You're looking at what the police saw when they came upon. They didn't know all the facts.
But what the police do know is that The mother has explained that her daughter has use of the car, and they also know they ran a check on David Brusky's name, and they apparently had no information that was alarming or gave them any reasonable suspicion.
Well, he didn't say that he had any authorization to be in the vehicle or that why he didn't offer any evidence to say why was I in this vehicle. He didn't know where he was. Isn't that?
That's right. He not that he didn't know where he was, but that he doesn't know how he got there. So I think I don't think just because a person's in a car that they can't explain their presence, that they lose the reasonable expectation of privacy in their personal items. Now, talking about what a police officer could have done, the police officer could have asked Ms. Smith, can I look in your car for the keys? Do you want me to help look? In fact, what did happen is Officer Beauchamp started searching the car, the interior of the car, the visor, in between the seats, etc. When he came upon the silver hard-shelled case, that was where he had to stop, and he had to get either a consent, or in this instance, it had to be consent to enter. There was no probable cause to believe that a crime had occurred. And since there was no probable cause to believe a crime had occurred, there's no basis to go into the case without consent or some other exigency.
May I ask? Yes. The owner of the car is there. The officers ask, do you have a key? And apparently the defendant said no. Isn't it logical that there's going to be some kind of a search for the key? And isn't that the common sense interpretation of what the owner of the car would want?
Well, Justice Prosser, you are addressing the implied consent angle of the state's argument. And as the circuit court ruled, first, the circuit court ruled that there wasn't any consent. As you know, consent is something that the state has a burden of proving. It's a question of fact, and the circuit court found that there was no consent implied or otherwise. But really what the state is asking you to do is to take a further leap and say not only did Ms. Smith implicitly consent to the search of the car, Mr. Brusky implicitly consented to the search of the travel bag. Ms. Smith could not consent to the search of that travel case.
Well, that gets back to I want to follow up the question on who has what burden here, because I think in the cases, and I think you're trying to make an argument analogous to Minnesota versus Olson, but there's the subsequent interpretation of who's got to establish. Is it an overnight guest? How much do they have to show in terms of the ability or the right to be where they're located? And if you're talking about somebody who's passing through in short term, I forget the name of the case, the U.S. Supreme Court said, well, then you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy. So, once again, isn't it his obligation to show that he's got an expectation of privacy? And then the question becomes, is it just in the travel bag, or is it in the travel bag and the car?
Well, Your Honor, if the court finds that the question of whether or not Mr. Brusky had a reasonable expectation of privacy in the vehicle is crucial, then the court should remand it back to Judge Lucci so that he could make a finding on that point. Judge Lucci interpreted the case as one involving the search of the travel case, and I submit that this court can reach that.
Ms. Maroney,
yes.
The answer to Justice Butler's question as to who has the burden of proof is, as you stated, the defendant, as to the reasonable expectation of privacy, right?
Correct.
If the defendant passes that burden and has a reasonable expectation of privacy, as I understood your argument, the burden would then be on the state to show that without a warrant, without, it has to fall within some exception.
That's right.
To make it reasonable, right?
That's okay. Right.
Now, Justice Crooks asked, how do you interpret the Court of Appeals decision? And I think you and he and I agreed that, and this is right from the opinion at page 106, quoting Arrakis, a person who cannot assert a legitimate claim, and no one seemed to assert a legitimate claim, they didn't assert that there was no legitimate claim, right? He asserted he knew the daughter. She said the daughter may have given it to someone. That's as far as he got.
Right? Well, I think what's fair to say is that there was no evidence that it was unlawful.
Okay. A person who cannot assert a legitimate claim to a vehicle cannot reasonably expect that a vehicle is a private repository for his personal effects, whether or not they're enclosed in some sort of container. Now, do you agree with that statement? A person who can't assert a legitimate claim can't expect anything in the car to be private?
No, I don't agree with that claim. Okay. I think that the authority that the Court of Appeals relied on and the authority that the state relies on concerns a situation where the individual was unlawfully in the car.
Stole the car.
Stolen car, or it was a rental car and he was not on the contract to drive.
Authorized. Okay.
So we don't have that. We have a situation where Judge Lucci did not believe that there was anything that gave rise to reasonable suspicion, even, much less probable cause that a crime had occurred.
That's why you're not going into the issue of the vehicle, because you think that if there's no argument that it's an illegitimate claim to the vehicle, we just go right to the depository.
I believe that what we have is a neutral situation regarding the car. Mr. Brusky is entitled to rely on the evidence that the state introduced, and what we know is he's sleeping in a car behind a building, and his travel case is on the floor in front of him. That is sufficient to show that he had a reasonable expectation of privacy in his bag.
My understanding that the state's position is, and they can correct it, that even if you have a legitimate right to be in the car, like the passenger in Matechka, that you don't have a right to privacy in any closed container you might have in the car. And in that case, you had a passenger, leaves a jacket in the car, police search the car, look into the jacket. Court says that's okay, no reasonable expectation of privacy. Court has a language in it that says, yeah, but don't stretch this to the purse.
That's right. And
that distinguishes you and the state.
It does, and I would ask the court to limit Matechka to its facts. The court made a hybrid third-party consent in that case, and
third-party was the owner of the
vehicle. The owner was Matechka, the driver who consented to the search of the van. Also what happened is that the passenger, Matechka, knew that the owner had consented to a search of the cab and left the vehicle and left her coat behind. So that distinguishes it from Mr. Brusky's case, because there's no evidence that Mr. Brusky knew when he left the car that the police were going to search the car. Yes, Your Honor.
May I ask now, after the search of the case, there was a search of the person of the defendant. Is that not right?
That's right.
Suppose the search of the defendant had come first. Would that have been justified? He's already said, I don't have the keys.
No, Your Honor, it would not have been justified. That's a serious intrusion into his personal rights, and there's no reasonable suspicion or probable cause. And I think that...
Well, if they thought he had a weapon.
If with the absence of it being a Terry stop, where there's reasonable suspicion of a crime or armed and dangerous, the police have no business doing a bodily search. And I guess...
So he would have, if he'd been in condition to do so, he would have been entitled simply to walk away without ever being required to submit to a search of his person. He had the keys.
They were not evidence of a crime. So, you know, maybe it would have been awkward for Ms. Smith, and she would have had to wait to make contact with her daughter to get the car back. But if Mr. Bruschi had walked away, the car would have remained there. The police could have escorted Ms. Smith back to her home where perhaps she had a key. But they had no reason to suspect Mr. Bruschi had stolen the car. So they had no reason to make such a serious intrusion into his private, personal right to be free from that type of intrusion.
Even if he hadn't stolen the car.
If he had stolen the car and the police officers knew that, and he said he didn't have the keys, there would be probable cause to search him for evidence of the keys.
Was this a normal place for the car to be?
Well, it was parked behind a house. It's not clear from the record whether it was parked on a paved parking lot or like a dirt area that was used for parking, but there's nothing to suggest that where it was parked was in an unusual location. It was in a private location because it wasn't on a public street.
Well, I think it's obvious that somehow that car got there. So cars don't operate on their own. So either the daughter drove it there or somebody else drove it there or the defendant drove it there.
That's right, Your Honor.
And the owner of the car wants to take control of her car. You don't do that if you don't have keys.
That's not enough to show that there's probable cause that a crime has been committed and permit an warrantless search of a person or their personal items. The officers could have asked Mr. Bruschi for consent to search him and his bag, but they did not.
But the issue, before you even get to probable cause, as I understand it, is the reasonable expectation of privacy. And isn't this, would this, you've described the presence in the automobile as being neutral. Would this be a very different case if he had established at the time of the stop that he had a right to be present in the automobile?
If he had established that?
Right.
His case would be weaker. I think that a reasonable inference from the evidence is that he did have a right to be in the vehicle. The daughter had use of the car. The daughter's clothes were in the car. He had the keys.
But he told the officer he didn't know where the keys were. So at the time the officers were doing their investigation, he said he doesn't know where the keys are. He only remembers at least the evidence shows that he only identified the daughter by the first name. You have the owner of the car there saying, I don't know who this guy is. So I think your description that this is neutral is accurate. But the question is, if reasonable expectation of privacy is the issue, and if it's relevant that he has to have reasonable expectation of privacy in the car, is this a different case if he establishes that he had a right to be present in that car versus a neutral explanation?
Yes, Your Honor. That would be a different case. And the court did not address that issue. Thank you, Your Honors.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Ms. Moroney. Stephen W. Kleinmeier, Assistant Attorney General representing the State of Wisconsin. Mr. Kleinmeier.
Yes, may it please the Court. I'm Stephen Kleinmeier, Assistant Attorney General representing the State of Wisconsin, the plaintiff appellant in this case. And I think the case is really just a question of sufficiency of the evidence, in that the issue in the Court of, as the Court of Appeals decided, was reasonable expectation of privacy. The defendant has the burden of proof on that issue, and it's a state position that the defendant didn't satisfy that burden of proof. I think the only evidence in the defendant's favor, first of all, the defendant agrees
I wonder if you could just tell us what the rule of law is about an automobile before we go into reasonable expectation of privacy so I can put it in a legal perspective. Do you agree with the Court of Appeals that a person who cannot assert a legitimate claim to a vehicle can't reasonably expect that any personal effects there are to be protected? That would require, as Justice Butler's questioning indicated, that he assert he was legitimately in the car, in possession of that car. You agree with that?
Frankly, I don't know, because I don't think we have to go that far.
How would you phrase it? I mean, your position is there was a reasonable he had no reasonable expectation of privacy in the car, therefore he had no reasonable expectation of privacy in the case.
No, that's not quite right. I don't have the therefore in there.
Okay.
My argument, and especially in the Court of Appeals and this Court, is primarily that he failed to show a reasonable expectation of privacy in the case. And consistent with that argument is the holding in these other cases, which said when you have no reasonable expectation of privacy in the car, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy in your effects in the car.
You do argue he had no reasonable expectation of privacy in the car, though.
Correct.
That's the first part of it.
On the ground that he failed to prove, failed to carry any burden. He failed to show it. As Justice Butler said, thought it might be neutral. I don't even know if it's be neutral, but I think my argument was an unexplained presence, and since he had the burden of proof and he failed to show any reason for being there, he failed to carry his burden of proof.
Kleinmeier, isn't that the rule that was in the Court of Appeals opinion, though? Isn't that a bit broad? I'm thinking of a situation where you have a person who is legitimately in a car. Let's say there's a reasonable expectation or probable cause that the driver of the car there's reasonable suspicion and probable cause as to the driver. Police have no reasonable expectation, no probable cause with respect to a passenger, and you have a closed container. Is it the state's position that the reasonable suspicion of probable cause as to the driver then transfers to the non-suspicious passenger, and that therefore their locked closed container may be searched?
Let me see.
It seems to me that the Court of Appeals opinion is a bit broad in that respect.
Well, I just want to sort through that, your hypothetical. You say, if it's probable cause about the driver, and if you have probable cause to believe that there's evidence in the car, then you can search, I think, is it the Houghton case? I believe you can search any container in the car, even that belonging to a passenger. Let me back up. That issue goes to the right to search. I don't think that necessarily addresses the passenger's reasonable expectation of privacy.
Right.
But I think under the Rakes case, it's kind of start out with the idea that the passenger probably doesn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the car. Now, his personal
affairs. I'm sorry, does or does not?
In a search, the car does not, although I think that there is a reference in Rakes, as I recall, maybe in a footnote, saying, well, we're not, something about not addressing his personal items.
We're talking about probable cause to search that car.
In which case the?
Rakes. Was there probable cause to search the car? The example given was that there was probable cause to search because of probable cause on the driver.
Well, that's the thing. The thing is, when there's probable cause that's going to, I think typically, as a practical matter, the reasonable expectation of privacy is not probably going to come up because the cases are pretty clear. If you have probable cause to arrest, then you search the car, passenger compartment of the car, instant the arrest. So stuff in there could be searched on that. And if there's probable cause, there's evidence in the car, then the whole car can be searched in containers. So once you have probable cause in there, I think just as a practical matter, people don't spend much time on reasonable expectation of privacy.
Cause, it comes under one of the exceptions of a right to search.
Right.
And you don't have that here.
No, we're not arguing.
We agree on that, right?
Right. We're not arguing as probable cause. I mean, if the state's position, if the court finds that Mr. Bruschi had a reasonable expectation of privacy in the case, then our argument is that the search was by consent.
Suppose that when he exited the car, he took his case with him. He's now standing outside the car, clutching the case. So they're searching the car for the keys. Can they search his case when he's got it in his hands?
If he's standing outside the car with it, no, I don't think so. Because our argument is that they had, once you're past reasonable expectation of privacy.
No. Does he have a reasonable expectation of the case when he's holding it in his hands?
I think if he's holding it in his hands, yes, he does.
Okay. But if he leaves it behind in the car, it's gone.
In this case, yes, because there was no showing as to how that case got there, who put it there. And, he didn't know how he got there. He was, the officer described him each time he saw him as it was hard to awake and he was, either sleeping or whatever. But he had there was no indication that he had any idea how that case got there.
So he failed to prove one of those six items on reasonable expectation, namely, complete dominion and control and right to exclude others.
Well, the only dominion and control he had, which is that, is consistent with possession.
You cite Matechka for the proposition that you leave something in the car and the car is searched, your privacy, reasonable expectation of privacy is gone.
No, I don't think we argue. Well, yes, because under the Rawlings case, I think it's consistent with that. When it's left, when you leave it in someone else's car, just as Rawlings left his drugs in, I think the woman's name was Cox, in her purse, and the court said he no longer had a reasonable expectation of privacy when he left it in her purse, I think this, leaving the case in Smith's car is the same thing as that.
So the lesson from the case, according to you, would be, if you're stopped and you're a passenger, take everything with you, clutching it.
Yeah.
Does that make sense under the Fourth Amendment? We're dealing with a constitutional issue.
Because when it comes to consent, we're talking about the owner of the car, the driver of the car's scope of authority of consent to search the car. If the item's not in the car, then I don't think would be consistent with that. But, of course, that's not the fact here.
No, and so even if he had, if he could show he had a legitimate right to possess that car, your position would be that the search for the keys allowed the search of his case? Because you objected to my saying therefore.
Yes. Well, therefore was in the context of a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Right, and that's what I'm talking about. If he had a legitimate claim to possession and could say, daughter, let me drive, daughter Jessica.
Yeah, then he could raise a challenge to the search, and then we wouldn't be arguing reasonable expectation of privacy. Then we'd be going directly to the state's argument about, well, even in that case, I think the search would have been pursuant to the owner's implied consent. And she would have had the authority to give consent to search the entire car for her keys to get her car back.
Okay.
So, I mean, his being, if he was legitimately in the car, I think we'd get past the reasonable expectation of privacy part. But I think the search in this case would still be valid under implied consent.
But if he doesn't have a legitimate claim, then it's not necessarily that he doesn't have a legitimate claim to his private property in the car. I'm trying to see if you don't have a legitimate claim to the car, can you still have a legitimate claim to your property in the car?
Well, but it's our argument he doesn't have. Well, okay.
That's my.
Yeah, I know, but I don't think that's this case. And
try and think as if it were this case.
Yeah. Well, my problem is I spent a lot of days researching this case, and we're throwing different facts. Frankly, I'm not sure. Just because he has no reasonable expectation of privacy in the car, he never has reasonable expectation of his effects in the car. Maybe he's sitting in his lap in the car. Maybe he's got something in his lap in the car. And then we're closer to your situation before if he's clutching it.
Mr. Kleinmeier, if I can follow up the Chief's question, and I know you're trying to steer clear of the hypotheticals, but I'm trying to determine how far this case goes and how far the Court of Appeals opinion goes. With respect, you suggested that if he had possession of the car, then you get beyond the reasonable expectation of privacy.
Can I stop you just a second? The key word there is possession, in the sense that the courts have said possession alone does not establish reasonable expectation of privacy.
Right. And I want to go a little bit, one step further. What if he is an individual who has a right to be in the car, but he is not the person in control of the car? Do you understand the question?
You mean like a passenger in their right?
Like a passenger. He's not the one who the car was given to. Let's say it was another individual, but he had a right to be there. He was there at the invitation of the person who was in possession. Would he have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that sense?
Well, I think we need more facts than that, because that's, I think, getting close to someone being in a person's house with consent. I mean, if you're an overnight guest, you have reasonable expectation of privacy. If you're just a social invitee, that's more of an open question, I think.
And the reason I ask the question is because the Court of Appeals decision goes beyond that, does it not? It pretty much establishes, as Ms. Moroney said, kind of a per se rule.
Well, I'm not sure it does. I think it's kind of ambiguous on that. In the sense, I realize it says, it uses the word as a matter of law, but I think we also have to consider the opinion in light of the standard of review, which is they give deference to the facts, but as how you interpret those facts, the legal conclusions you apply to those facts is a legal question. So in that sense, well, put it, to reverse it a little, if this, you know, a year from now another case comes up and I want to cite Brusky for a per se rule that, you know, they wouldn't have reasonable expectation of privacy, good defense attorneys would come back and say, no, not necessarily. That matter of law just meant they were applying the standard review to the facts of that case and concluded as a matter of law that on the facts of this case there's no reasonable expectation of privacy. So, frankly, I'm not sure that that's a per se rule in that case. As to the burden of proof, in this case, I think all the defendants showed, even to the travel case, was the possession, and that was basically based on the statement of the officers and the concession by the prosecutor during the final argument, that it says, as it turned out, it was the defendant's case. But beyond that, there's no evidence to support him. He keeps saying that it was a personal case. Well, how do we know it's personal? It's a plastic case. It's 12 to 10 inches by 16 inches by 8 inches, and it's a plastic case, and in it the police find marijuana and drug paraphernalia. There's also no evidence in the suppression hearing that the marijuana and paraphernalia belonged to the defendant. No, he was charged because he was close to it. Under Maryland versus Pringle, just being in the car with the substance is enough for probable cause to charge the person. But so we don't know that was even his stuff that was in the case. We don't know how it got where it was. We don't know how the car got where it was. I mean, Jessica's clothes were in the car. Her mother said she is the one who had the car at least the night before. I mean, she could have had as much access to that case as the defendant. So, I mean, there's just so many questions, unanswered questions, which is speculation, which means you can't make a finding. You can't even draw an inference on these facts. I mean, to make a conclusion on reasonable expectation of privacy.
What would he have to do to show that this case was private? Would it have to have letters on it saying private? I mean, most people think if you put things in a piece of luggage, it's yours and you're private.
Well, the only reason it's a plastic case, the only reason they can call it luggage is a police officer happened to label it a makeup travel case.
Well, what do you call it?
I call it a plastic case. It could be a fishing tackle box. It could be a toolbox. It could be, you know, a plastic case. Could be anything.
Your makeup kit.
That's right. A makeup kit, if you're looking at that, you got women's clothes in the car. Most people would draw the conclusion, would connect the makeup case to the woman's clothes. So, I mean, I don't know what that means. It doesn't show that it was defendant's personal case.
Whose eyes at the time that the case was seized, and we're talking, these are all very factual intensive, all of the, you know, the search and seizure. And we've heard a different variety of questions going back here for opposing counsel and yourself. So what you're saying is that based on these facts, that what the police did, and do you look at hindsight, or do you look what we knew? What the police knew at the time, That's what we look at, don't we?
Well, unreasonable expectation of privacy, no, Your Honor. It's, since it's a defendant's burden of proof.
Yep, which he didn't.
Which I say he didn't, yes, he didn't right, carry. But I mean, to carry it, a defendant could, reasonable expectation of privacy can and frequently is, I think, decided on information unknown to the police and information there's no way the police could know. In fact, the Orta case that we've cited in this case, I think, makes that point. That
I understand that, but here there was nothing offered. He didn't meet that burden.
Correct.
That's what I'm...
That's the State's argument, right. Yes.
But you got a subjective view. The defendant didn't testify here, did he?
No. But just to the extent there is a subjective view, I think the fact he doesn't know how he even got there is an indication that how could he have a subjective expectation of privacy when he's not even aware of where he is or he's not aware of how he got there.
Isn't that the very statement? He didn't know how he got there, so how could he have a reasonable expectation of privacy? Isn't that the very statement in paragraph 18 that's been the subject of questioning and you don't want to commit on? The statement is, a person who cannot assert a legitimate claim to a vehicle cannot reasonably expect the vehicle is a private repository for his personal effects.
Well, I'm citing it as just one indication that the thing he failed to show. And I mean, as far as subjective, the Orta case points out how locking a door can be an indication of a subjective expectation of privacy. There's no evidence in here that anything was locked. The police officer was able to open the passenger door immediately. There was no indication this travel case was locked. So, I mean, that's, of the information in this record, that indicates there was no subjective expectation of privacy.
And I was going to ask, and you're already, I think, answering it, given the facts here, if we embellish the facts a bit, what kind of proof in my embellishment of the facts would satisfy this reasonable expectation of privacy? Would indeed, if this plastic case were locked, would that be sufficient proof to carry a burden of a reasonable expectation of privacy?
Your Honor, I don't know, because these things are all fact-specific. In the courts, each party has cited, maybe we cite different cases, but I think it's the same thing, that there's at least six factors this court has set out to be considered the objective part of expectation of privacy. I mean, you have to look at all those factors in the context of each case. So in this particular case, I don't know which particular factor. It was his burden to bring them up. He didn't.
What rule of law is this opinion, if we follow your argument? If this case is written consistent with your argument, what rule of law will this case stand for?
Nothing new, because all it will say is there are already cases saying possession alone is not enough to show reasonable expectation of privacy. That's all the defendant has. He failed to show anything else, and so because he failed to show anything beyond possession, he failed to carry his burden of proof to show reasonable expectation of privacy.
That's why I asked the question, because you emphasize this is a sufficiency of evidence case. I mean, you're not really advancing, it seems to me, you're advancing other things, but your main argument is this is a sufficiency of evidence case and the defendant has the burden and hasn't met it. I mean, that's in a nutshell what I understand your argument.
Yes, reasonable expectation of privacy, yes it is.
So, okay.
Error correcting in some ways.
Well, I don't know. My guess would be it was primarily because of the defendant's claim that the Court of Appeals opinion created a per se rule. And on that, I think the opinion is ambiguous.
Okay. And the per se rule that the defendant claims is when you have, when you can search a car, that you can search everything in it. Is that the per se rule? Tell me what you think the per se rule is.
Not quite. I think their interpretation of the per se rule is when the defendant has no reasonable expectation of privacy in the car, then he has no reasonable expectation of privacy in any particular item in the car. Now, that's, I think, a little bit different than from saying if you can search a car, that necessarily means you can search everything in the car. The second part,
different?
I think, may involve different factors.
Like what?
Well, in Metechka, the court indicated that although the driver's consent to search the car included the passenger's coat in that case, they said the court said, well, maybe it wouldn't, or maybe, or it wouldn't, or there was, but there was a draw distinction between something like a purse or something like that. So in other words, that created a situation where the consent would go to permit some items in the car, but not other items. In this case, I think if the court finds Bruski had reasonable expectation of privacy in the case, then I think we get to the consent question. And I think this, Smith's gave her implicit consent for the police to search the car. And I think her consent in this case would include anything in the car, because what she wanted her car back. They asked the defendant for the keys. They didn't have it. So now they're looking for the keys. And a key can be anywhere in the car. So I think her consent would go to anywhere in the car to find her key so she can get her car back. I mean, as the trial court pointed out, and this case is different from Metechka, and I think one important part that favors the state. Metechka, they asked the driver for consent to search for guns, weapons, and drugs. This case, as the trial court said, was not a search for drugs or weapons or evidence of any kind. It was to get the woman's keys back for her car. And I think in that context, her consent would go to anything that could contain the keys in the car. And in fact, at some point in Bruski's brief, he draws a distinction between the situation where the officer, Beecham or Beauchamp, said, first of all, he thought he had permission to look for the keys because the owner was standing there wanting the keys, and he started looking for the keys. After the drugs were found, then he asked for permission to search the trunk. And the argument was, well, that indicates he didn't really think he had permission at all. But I think, to the contrary, I think it supports the argument that the police believed they had permission to search the car to help Smith get her car back, because at pages 130 and 131 of the state's appendix, which is the suppression hearing, Beecham is talking about, especially on page 31, he says after the narcotics were found, he says, at this point, I began to wonder, where is this girl? I didn't have any idea, so I was going to look in the trunk. And I asked Smith if it's okay to look at the trunk, and she says, yeah, by all means. I think that shows that the police officer, when he thought he was looking for the keys to help her get the car back, he was operating with her implied consent, or her consent. When the purpose of the search is switching from looking for the keys to get the car back to wondering now what happened to the girl, and is her body maybe in the trunk of the car, now he asks for consent, which I think just supports the idea that they, about the consent to search to help her get the car back to get the keys. But when it goes beyond that, when the search for a different purpose, then he knows enough to ask for consent.
The trial court found there was no consent. Is that right? And what is that? How do we evaluate that finding?
Because I think the court was just wrong on its legal theory. At page 109 to 110 of the appendix in Bruski's original brief, the red brief, at the bottom of 109, the top of 110, the court says, the law provides a state must demonstrate clearly and convincingly consent was given. And in the absence of any legal authority supporting a theory of implied or constructive consent, the court must find the consent was not given by the owner, even though it's certainly reasonable to assume under these circumstances it would have been granted had the officers requested consent to search before the actual search and not later. I think what the court erred is in saying there's no legal authority for implied consent. I mean, we've cited several cases, some from Wisconsin, some from out of state, where there's consent is implied when a person calls for police assistance. Now, sometimes it's the defendant who's calling to report a crime. Frequently it's been murder, but they'll call to report a crime. Maybe apparently to steer the police a different direction, but the courts have said even when the defendant calls to report a crime and where it is, that gives the police implied consent to come and look around and investigate the crime. Here, it's even more likely, it's more reasonable to say that Smith gave her implied consent. She wasn't a defendant. She'd done nothing wrong. She just wants her car back. And the court recognized that when he said it's certainly reasonable to assume she would have granted consent.
Well, what about 114, where the judge says, under the circumstances herein, I guess this is a motion to reconsider, the owner of the vehicle not only did not give implied consent for the police to search the car, but she also could not give such consent to search the defendant's travel bag.
Well, I think it's still based on the court's understanding that the law wouldn't permit a finding of implied consent in this case. Because it's...
Well, they say that she didn't allow them to search the car. That's what the court says. That there was no implied consent to search the car. Then they say, but had she given implied consent to search the car, she couldn't have consented to search the defendant's travel bag. Now, you may disagree with
yes.
the latter part, but the finding was she never gave implied consent to search the car.
And he made that as a legal conclusion.
Well, then there's an issue of how do you review consent. I don't know that the cases are consistent. Some indicate consent is factual, and so you have to check if there's enough evidence to support it. Others view it as a constitutional thing to look at the facts, historical facts, but that whether or not there was consent as a constitutional matter is, or as a legal matter, is for the appellate court.
Yeah, my understanding.
It was yours.
Pardon?
The cases seem to not be consistent.
Yeah, the one I usually look at it is Phillips, because there's a long discussion, and then there is a recognition there of distinction. I think there, my understanding is like whether the defendant, whether his words or conduct qualify as consent is a factual question, and then like whether it's voluntary, or that kind of question is legal. Here, I think that what blocked the trial court was the trial court finding there's no theory for implied consent under any circumstances, so the court never really made any factual findings on whether what Smith did would qualify as implied consent, since the court just said there's no legal theory to support it to begin with.
Well, if we accept that, and this case would, if it turns on consent, would have to go back for findings by the trial court?
I don't think it would, but the state would certainly not object. I mean, if you want to give the trial court, I mean, I think the facts as they stand are pretty clear, but since the trial court stopped at the point of saying, well, there's just no legal theory that allows it, so I'm not, you know, basically saying I'm not going to go on, if the court would want to send it back for a fact-finding under the legal theory of implied consent, the state would have no objection. I think the court's outcome is indicated, is suggested, though, by the trial court statement. Again, this is carrying over from the very end of 109 to 110 of Brewski's appendix, where he says, under the circumstances, it would have been granted if the police requested. So, I mean, he's saying that under these circumstances, it's clear Smith wanted the assistance. I mean, she came to the police department, asked for police assistance because she was concerned about her daughter, and she wanted her car back. So, and I think when she asked for police assistance, then I think that that's she's implicitly consenting to the police doing whatever is necessary to accomplish whatever task it is she's asking them to assist in.
Neither one of you has argued the state constitutional law issue of moving away from reasonable expectation of privacy to the old rule of automatic standing for your own property. Now, Callaway is usually cited by both of you as the case that adopted the federal rule on reasonable expectation of privacy, right?
Not quite right that way. They rejected automatic standing under the Wisconsin Constitution, but I think the Filial case was a little before that, and even was already applying reasonable expectation of privacy. And Callaway has been cited by other cases as rejecting automatic standing. And to my knowledge, I have never found a case applying automatic standing under the Wisconsin Constitution. There was only like a 20-year period that the federal courts had 20-year automatic standing. And during that period, the cases cited in Callaway and the only ones I could find discussing automatic standing were always in the context of the Fourth Amendment.
Yeah, but this court followed the United States Supreme Court.
In rejecting automatic standing, yes.
And it followed the United States Supreme Court previously in adopting automatic standing.
I never found a case where Wisconsin adopted automatic standing under the Wisconsin Constitution.
Yes, yes, I agree. Not under the Wisconsin Constitution,
okay.
But in Wisconsin cases, they applied.
They applied it, yes, because it was a Fourth Amendment question.
Right, and the state constitution had not been briefed in that, but Callaway says
Justice Coffey says, cites three cases that in Wisconsin the U.S. Supreme Court decisions were applied under the Fourth Amendment.
Yeah, I know I cited those three cases.
But Monahan, Marbra, and Christel.
And, but I mean, I think it's...
But there's no Wisconsin Constitution.
I'm aware of no case that where Wisconsin ever adopted automatic standing under the Wisconsin Constitution, and to my knowledge, as far as I know, this is the first time, but now this is 24 years as that's sort of been rejected. And I did a search the other day. I finally came up with like 267 cases since 1973 that discussed either legitimate expectation of privacy or reasonable expectation of privacy. Those phrases, I can't guarantee they all were standing questions because I didn't look at all 267, but I think there's a substantial body of law been built up on that.
You don't want us to have you brief those 273 cases?
No. Well, I couldn't brief all of them because many of them were listed as unpublished. But even the published ones, it would be quite a burden to go back and look at all of them, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier. Ms. Maroney?
Thank you. I want to return to a question that was asked in my argument in chief, and that is if a person doesn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the vehicle, can they assert a reasonable expectation of privacy in the item searched? And the court's Matichka case demonstrates that a person who does not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the vehicle yet could have a reasonable expectation of privacy in a personal item left in the car. And that footnote referring to we're not discussing whether or not perhaps a purse or pocketbook, something more personal than a coat, could still retain the reasonable expectation of privacy. I also want to point the court to its recent decision last term, Sykes. The court said consent is a question of fact that needs clear and positive and specific evidence. And here, there is no evidence of common authority over the bag. And finally, the state refers to the Rawlings case, and that is a case where Rawlings put his drugs in Ms. Cox's purse. The court said since he didn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the purse, he didn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy, period. And the reason he didn't is that by putting them in another's purse, he was exposing them to view. Cox saw them. And also he was exposing or taking the risk that Cox would let somebody else see him. In this case, Mr. Ruskey did not reveal the contents of his bag, and he did not take the risk that some other person would reveal the contents of his bag. And I would ask this court to reject the state's argument that this car was a purse. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Maroney, and thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier, for presenting yet another case relating to the validity of a search and seizure. But we're not done yet because the following case, the Johnson case, raises at least the same constitutional doctrines. So thank you both. That ends the hearing on 05AP1516CR. State v. Ruskey. We'll take a few minutes of recess so that the students who are here who wish to leave may do so. And